Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to A Celtic State of Mind. I'm Paul John Dykes, and once again I am joined by Kevin Graham for another instalment of Screamer Celica. Kevin, welcome back. How are you doing?
Not too bad, Paul. How's yourself?
I'm okay, and I'm delighted that you're once again going to regale us with your memories of an important album from your life. Which album is it, and when was this LP released?
So the album this week was released on the 17th of May 2004, and it's A Grand Don't Come For Free by The Streets. Now, this was Mike Skinner's second album with Streets Project, and it was a bit different from his debut album, which was also well received because it was basically a concept album, a rap concept album, and quite unusual because concept albums seem to disappear from fashion in the mid-70s, and the only other two concept albums I've probably listened to before A Grand Don't Come For Free would have been Tommy and obviously Quadrophenia. So it's a series of 10 songs done in a UK garage style, but it's got a loose narrative of a character called Mike, strangely enough, who loses £1,000, then meets a girl, falls out with the girl, cheats on the girl, she cheats on him with his pal, he finds £1,000 again. Or does he find £1,000 again? Because the album's got two endings. Now, if anybody hasn't listened to the album, I've probably just spoiled that for them. But
spoiler alert, yes.
Spoiler alert there, eh? So again, it's one of these albums that, when I was thinking about this earlier on, I can't say that I've got any other UK garage albums in my record collection. And maybe the fact that I'm into The Streets was more to do with the fact that the music press that I read were into Mike Skinner rather than me being into UK garage. So maybe that says more about me than I maybe like it today, truthfully. But what I really like about original Pirate material and this album and other albums that he's made is he's a storyteller. He was a storyteller on the first album, but he took this, he supersized it, his storytelling on this album. I mean, it's either a stroke of genius or lunacy that the fact that he decided to write A Grand Don't Come For Free the way that he done it, because he had been reading country and western songwriting manuals and he wanted to see if it worked. And it does work. And I really love the fact is that out of the 10 songs, and it's something that I try to do when I write stuff as well, especially at the moment when I'm writing something longer form, is the set pieces, or in this case, the songs, can all be listened to individually. And you don't need to listen to the ones that preceded it or the ones that go after it to get an understanding of the story, of the meaning of that song, of the drama in that song. And I like the fact that he uses simple vocabulary, but he also uses simple beats. There's a simplicity to the Streets music, which we spoke before, which is extremely difficult to do and get it right. And when you look at the songs that are on this album as well, the first single was Fit But You Know It, and which is a bit of, I think it's a bit raucous. It's a raucous song. It's out of place on the album when you hear it in the album context. And in the video, he done the video with Danny Dyer and Ray Winston and other guys for the Football Factory. And that gave him this sort of lad, geezer-type image, which he had got on the first album as well. But again, that could have been the press. That's just the way... And he played up to it. And you've got Dry Your Eyes, which is one of the most heartbreaking songs ever. Yeah. The lyrics in Dry Your Eyes, he paints pictures with those words. And it's utterly fantastic, but it's simple. It's one beat and an acoustic guitar. There's not, and some strings. There is nothing grand about it, but it's got this sense of drama, this sense of occasion, this sense of heartfelt emotion. And I've mentioned on the podcast quite a few times that I really like Mike Skinner, and I like his autobiography. It's one of the best autobiographies that I've read, and he's extremely honest in the autobiography. And when he talks about Dry Your Eyes, it was meant to be recorded with Chris Martin for Coldplay singing the chorus, and the reason it didn't happen was because he changed the lyrics the day before it was mastered.
Right.
And that's how Chris Martin never ended up singing duetting, if it would be a duet, singing the chorus of Dry Your Eyes.
And so is there a version kicking about? Was it actually recorded?
There is a version. I don't think it's out. I've never been able to find it. I'm sure it maybe is out there. Maybe there is a version. If you go to YouTube and type The Streets versus Muse, there is a song that was never released either as well, when he collaborated with Muse. And what he was actually saying about Dry Your Eyes, he says he gets all these people coming up saying, oh, this means this means that, it must be so emotional for you to sing it live. And he basically says in the book, he's going, I'm just trying to remember the words and where I'm at. And he completely flattens your expectations of live music, going,
I know.
Well, I don't know. When I wrote the song, folks say, oh, you must have been really emotional when you wrote it. And he's went, well, I've rewritten it about 26, 27 times. You see, so whatever emotion that you had has now just been worked into the craft of the songwriting. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to say my Tommy Burns poem is like Dry Your Eyes by the Streets, but what I'm trying to get at is the Tommy Burns poem means different things to the different people that have heard it, and it captures something, it captures an emotion in people. And I reckon that this is what Mike Skinner means by Dry Your Eyes as well, that it's no longer his song, it's out there, it's the nations, it's getting used when England were put out of the 2004 Euro Championship. When they got beat on penalties by Portugal that year, I might be wrong.
Shame.
And that was played when they show the montage at the end, all the England fans greeting and the players greeting. So it's got that sort of cultural significance. And so's that album. That album was a massive album, and it propelled Mike Skinner and the Streets project into maybe not quite superstardom, but a life of excess. And his face was on the side of buses, on bus stops, because he became the face of Reebok. And it's a good album.
Better than being the face of Puma, isn't it?
Or Car Store, or whatever they're called. Or,
the thing is, Reebok is very much the old British label, isn't it? It's a British brand where the butcher's apron has been used numerous times by Reebok. So I always think of Mike Skinner as being that, you know, just probably because he's vernacular when he's rapping away. But I can can see him with a Ralph Lauren polo shirt and a pair of Reeboks on. I probably would say they would be his best gutties. But Kevin, you've mentioned a few things here. First of all, with regards to concept albums, a lot of the time I think there are concept albums that maybe the artist doesn't say this is a concept album. The concept being, if it's not just a clutch of 10 or 12 songs that sit well together that you wrote around about the same time, then it's just a normal LP. I don't think many bands write an album where it's just a clutch of 12 songs that just drop on a mixing desk and get released. So I think there's a concept to most albums. And you mentioned there, his concept is it's a story, obviously, a narrative running through all the songs, and it works really well. I mean, I've never lost a grand in my house. I've never lost a grand anywhere. I was going to ask yourself, you didn't do these things. You didn't lose grands down the back of the telly, you know what I mean?
It's such a flimsy storyline. It really is a flimsy storyline. But it's the way that he tells it, it like ties it together. It's basically like if you ever go to a bar or you sit next to an old guy at a bar or some of the events that we do, guys come up and tell you stories and they exaggerate bits and they really drag you in and there's no really much happens in the story, but the way that they tell it is so entertaining that they make the mundane things sound really, really entertaining. And I think that's what he does here. I think, like, there's a song on it about spread betting, and he makes it sound entertaining. There's a song on it about just sitting in the house watching the telly. The imagery that he actually conjures up is fantastic. And it's just the way that he's used the words and the simple beats. I think he's turned a flimsy narrative. I mean, it is losing money, meeting a girl, falling out with a girl, then getting the money back, falling out with your pals. It's just such a flimsy narrative that if it wasn't for the music and his songwriting skill, wouldn't hold together.
It wouldn't hold up. But in terms of concept albums, interestingly enough, in the same year, there was another concept album released, which I own, and it was John Squire's second solo record, Marshall's House. Did you invest in any John Squire solo stuff? Were you a fan of Squire when he broke from the Seahorses and released a couple of albums?
No, I haven't. No? Purchased any John Squire solo stuff, no.
Right, well, you've mentioned on this particular feature podcast that you believe that the BDI discography will be appreciated retrospectively. The two John Squire albums are really, really good and well worth seeking out and listening to, both of them. Both of them. The second one is a concept album. The first one, Time Changes Everything, is just beautiful songwriting, really great lyrics, brilliant guitar playing, and just great to see Squire, you know, getting back to what he does best. And it's got a really, really cool Stone Roses-esque front cover with a Jackson Pollock splashed paint on a skull. But the second album was called Marshall's House, and every song, this will appeal to you, Kevin, every song is inspired by and shares its title with a painting by Edward Hopper. Because everybody knows John Squire, first and foremost, was an artist. He worked for the company that made Wind in the Willows. So he painted all he was one of the painters of the frogs and the characters of Wind in the Willows. And he was an artist, and obviously his art ended up on the front cover of all the albums, the Stone Roses, iconic imagery. So one of his favourite artists is Edward Hopper. So he, like what you were saying before about writing poetry to Mogwai song titles, he wrote an album inspired by Hopper, and it didn't sell that well, to be fair, and it's one of the ones that, you know, people kind of forget about, but when you listen back to it, it's a fantastic second album by John Squire. Quite low-key. There's a great song in it called Cape Cod Morning, which is the best song on the album, but that came out in 2004 as well. You've always been a big Mike Skinner fan. My relationship with his music probably spanned the first two albums, Kevin. I thought when he came out, it was fresh, and that, you know, continued, that momentum continued into the second album. The big hit, you know, that you mentioned already, Fit But You Know It, I can't stand that song. Can't stand it. It's just kind of like, you know, bloke-ish, out, getting bevied, all that kind of stuff, which was never really my bag. So I didn't like that single. But then on the flip side, Dry Your Eyes is just a masterpiece. This was his biggest selling LP, his first number one. And as you say, it really put him on the map in terms of a big artist who obviously people like Chris Martin or Muse would like to work with. But I was quite surprised looking at this because it's number two of five albums that Mike Skinner's released under the Streets. Have you continued to follow his career? I know you certainly were a fan. And if so, What's his output been like since this particular album came out?
Yes, I did continue following the streets. The next album, if I can remember the name of it, The Hardest Way to Make an Easy Living, is like a rock and roll breakdown album where he basically just lays into the music business, and he lays into probably more personal than the character-based Grand Don't Come For Free. The one after that, Everything Is Borrowed, he didn't use any electronics on it, and he didn't speak about it. He used to mention everyday stuff, and he says he wasn't going to do that. Everything Was Borrowed, it's got Never Went To Church on it, which is basically a rip-off of Let It Be, and Paul McCartney did get royalties for it. I like Everything Is Borrowed. I think it's a more organic album. Obviously, by this point, he's not selling very much records, and the record company, it was a five-album deal, and he was having some issues just after he released the fourth album. He had depression, and he also got ME, so that put him out of the game for over a year. And his last album, Computer and Blues, I think he had recorded for a couple of years, and it was eventually released very low key, but it was just basically fulfilling his contract with 6, 7, 9 records, I think, at that point. I've been to see him twice. I saw him just towards the end of Everything Is Borrowed at the Picture House in Edinburgh, which is no longer there. That was a great gig. Then I saw him on the comeback tour there in 2017 at the...
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
O2 Academy. And it was a really, really good night. His newer stuff's a bit more grimish, a bit more hard hitting. He's got a new mix album coming out, and he's recently released a track with Tame Impala, which was released a couple of weeks ago, I think. I must admit, going to see him, it was a bit nostalgic, but he's reinterpreted the songs with a live band. Robert Harvey is now part of his band, the singer, guitarist from a band me and you liked, The Music, who actually released an album this year.
So both The Streets and The Music released an album in 2004, and Robert Harvey and Mike Skinner teamed up as D.O.T. Later on. And it's now interesting that obviously Harvey is part of The Streets.
A couple of interesting things about what he was doing for 2011. He wrote the music for the Inbetweeners movie, and he wrote 14 songs for the Inbetweeners movie, and he also run a club night with a Manchester artist called Murkage Dave, called Tonga, which seemed to, and he became a sort of a DJ as well. He also released tracks under the name The Darker the Shadow, The Brighter the Light, and he's now claimed those are actually The Streets tracks, and he just didn't want to put them out as The Streets, just because of the reaction that they might have got, or the baggage they might have carried when he stuck them out. He always seems quite a complicated fella, and he always seems to maybe overthink things, and which seems strange. He seems a bit of a perfectionist. He seems a bit of, things take time with him, and if he's not happy with it, doesn't see the light of day, see the Chris Martin, see Muse, see the fact of releasing songs under a different moniker, because he didn't really want The Streets label on it. But he seems to be, The Streets have done now two comeback tours. He's got the Mix album, and then there is another Streets album in the pipeline. The stuff that I've heard from it, it's a bit harder than the Streets. If you're looking for stuff like Blinded by the Lights and Dry Your Eyes, you're not going to get that now. He has moved by the times. Could be a tough listen for a casual fan.
I mean, it was interesting because I've not followed his career as closely as you have, and I didn't know that you had worked on some tracks for the In Between Us movies, which, you know, isn't as impressive as Clint Boone doing the music for the Engie Benji cartoon series, which I was far more impressed with, Kevin. However, at that time, 2004, obviously the world of Celtic was in a good place. We were managed by Martin O'Neill. Many fans of the modern age cite Martin O'Neill as the greatest manager that they have ever seen at Celtic Park. I don't know if you share that view, Kevin. I've always said, and I've said it a few times, my favourite manager is Tommy Burns, even though he's not been as successful as Neil Lennon or Brendan Rodgers or Martin O'Neill. But I did love O'Neill. I loved his time at the club and the team that he built. Now, we had an interesting conversation here because when you talk to some of the old heads, as you invariably do if you're involved in writing Celtic books or doing Celtic podcasts, etc., then some, in fact, quite a few of them will tell you that the team that won the European Cup wasn't the best Jockstein Celtic team. You know, guys like David Potter and Tom Campbell argue that the team that developed a couple of years later were a far better side, but they didn't win the European Cup, so they'll never be thought of as such. From our era, Kevin, people will say, well, Martin O'Neill's treble winners are the best team. It's hard to argue that the team that went to the UEFA Cup final were a better side because, you know, ultimately they didn't win anything that season. But this season, following Seville, 2003-2004, is up there when it comes to the finest Martin O'Neill team. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I remember the night that I was driving you to the Royal Concert Hall. And
was that when I was writing the questions on the way?
That was right when you were writing the questions on the way, yes.
I just handed you my keys and said, you can drive.
You can drive, aye. And
listen, Kevin, there was only 1,500 folk there. You know, what could have gone wrong?
No, nothing. I mean, we wing this all the time. I wing this all the time. So I says to you on the way through that I reckoned that the 2003-2004 team were better than the Seville team.
You did, and you told me to ask that, and I didn't have to ask it because they brought it up.
Because Neil Lennon offered it up when somebody asked him about when you mentioned Seville, and he says, and he says right away, no, we were better the following season. Mm-hmm. And that season was probably as close as we would get to total domination. And that season, if we would have wanted it, we could have went unbeaten in that league season. We could have done it quite easily.
Yeah, yeah.
And
because we had won the league before we were defeated.
We won the league with six games to go. And Martin O'Neill came out, and I checked this today. Martin O'Neill came out after the Kilmarnock game when we won the league. And this is a bit of a contradiction, a sentence which Martin was extremely good at. He says, I want to go through the league season unbeaten, but this gives me a chance to rest players and bring in some youngsters. And you're going, well, that doesn't really balance up what you're trying to achieve here, eh? And we won the league on the Sunday, and I think we got beat against Aberdeen on the Wednesday night at Celtic Park. So Brendan Rodgers had an invincible season. But when I look back on this season, that team was almost as relentless as Brendan's first season team. And there seemed to be, the season before, we didn't win anything. We had a fantastic season, but we didn't win anything. Rangers had a tainted treble, as it has been proven after 2012, when it was found out that the majority of the team that season were all wrongly registered. So that treble's forever going to be tainted. Should have an asterisk next to it.
All this chat about asterisks, right, I think, like, going back to calling players Rolls Royces, we need to be a wee bit more imaginative. Let's forget the asterisks and just put a skull next to all the titles that they won, right? Just put a skull, you know, maybe even with crossbones behind it, just to remind us that that team is now dead. I think that's better than an asterisk. What do you reckon?
That's a good idea, that, eh?
Let's start using a skull.
Just start using a skull.
No, but you're right, it was, and it's been proven as a tainted treble. But the point you make is a great point, Kevin. I think Brendan Rodgers and O'Neill, and I don't know either of them personally, I will be speaking to Martin O'Neill on the 18th of September, just a wee plug for a show that sold out in Glasgow. Interesting enough, talking about Sutton and Lennon, It's going to be Chris Sutton and John Hartson that night. And I've spoken to the two of them. I said, I'm actually a bit nervous about speaking to O'Neill. And he says, so are we. So so I'm in good company. But O'Neill and Rogers are obviously different beasts. And I think it would have meant more after the league was won for Rogers to go through a league campaign invincible, whereas O'Neill probably would have accepted a couple of defeats just to make sure that he was resting his first pick team for the Scottish Cup final, you know, and perhaps could bleed in one or two youngsters. So I think that that comes down to the manager, you know, the difference in personality of the manager. You've got Rogers, who, you know, would take it as a personal slight if his team lost the game to Aberdeen. Now, there was a couple of defeats at the end of the Martin O'Neill season, but I think O'Neill would just take that. He would take that. But you're right, we were very close to having an invincible season, and you know, when you look at the team that knocked us out of the League Cup, Hibs, they were in turn defeated in the final by Livingston.
The story at Hibs game, we beat them 6-0, I think, a week later at Celtic Park. That Hibs game, and this maybe shows you how devalued the League Cup was to us at this point. It was a midweek game, and we had to squeeze in two League Cup games. I think the first one was against Partick Thistle at the start of December. Then we got put out the Champions League to Lyon when Bobo decided to punch the ball. And then we had to go to Easter Road the following midweek. And I was at Easter Road that midweek, and the place was empty. The Celtic end, there wasn't a big travelling support went, eh? And it was very flat the whole night. It was cold. It was, I think, about 10 days before Christmas. And it was no surprise when I walked out that ground that we had got beat. It was just one of the nights that we just didn't seem to be up for it whatsoever, on and off the park as well, eh? And, I mean, we would have got Rangers in the semi-final, because Hibs bet Rangers in the semi-final. But I can't remember at the time as there been much wailing and gnashing our teeth at the fact that we had blew a treble. I still think, you look at the end of that season, look at the end of the season before, after that day at Rugby Park, there was not one Celtic fan you would have asked who wouldn't have said that Celtic team were far better than that Rangers team that won a treble. We were a far better side. And going into the following season, I think the players had that bit between their teeth that they knew they were a far better side than that Rangers team. And what they'd done that season proved it, undoubtedly. And so I don't really remember when we got put out of the League Cup, there wasn't a big fuss, because we were in the UEFA Cup and we were looking forward to maybe going deep into the UEFA Cup again. We were looking forward to, I think we were maybe 11 points clear in the league by that point. We had won the first two Celtic Rangers games, and we ended up winning 5 Celtic Rangers games that season. We also won 4 against them in the league, which is the first time that was ever done.
The points you're making there are so valid, though, Kevin, because, you know, really, when you compare the two, if you're looking at, people would generally say, oh, the Rogers treble side against O'Neill's treble side. But when you look at this particular season, the fact is, you know, Celtic were still playing European football right up until April. And Rogers didn't have that. Rogers didn't have that to contend with, that European run, that vast European run that season. So in order to go, obviously, and give his first pick or his first teamers a rest after their exertions in Europe, I think O'Neill probably was right to rest a few of them. And as a result of that, we lost a couple of games, and that's why it wasn't an invincible season. But it's a great debate.
The other thing as well, what we've got to remember is Martin O'Neill signed the core of this team in 2001, and they weren't young guys. The average age of that side at that point must have been touching 29-30, because there was a lot of old heads in that team. Henrik Larsson was coming up 33. Neil Lennon would have been coming up 33. I mean, he signed Alan Thompson as Thompson was 27, 28. O'Neill signed a lot of experienced players. So you're talking about that team was in the veteran stage, maybe, but they were in their final lap, really. And maybe it was just the age of the side and the mentality of those players who knew, right, we've got 6 games left, we've won the league. The only 2 games that we need to win this season are the cup final and the last Celtic Rangers game. And maybe there was an automatic switch off where under Brendan, the team's a bit younger, hungrier, and just decided we'll keep on going. Maybe the team was fitter as well. You've maybe got to say that, because I don't want to go on to the 2004-2005 season when we did run out of legs. But you look at the 2003-2004 season. We beat Barcelona, a very, very good Barcelona side. Then we ran out of steam against Villarreal, who were a hard-working Spanish team. They weren't spectacular. They weren't Barcelona, but we just couldn't get. We seemed to hit a level. And fade Villarreal. After the Villarreal game, there seemed to be a dip, even though we ended up winning the league and winning the Scottish Cup. We just seem to pick ourselves up for certain games and then move on. And I wonder if that's got something to do with the age of the side and the experience in the side.
It's all about prioritising. Now, it was a great season, a fantastic season, but it ended for me on a bit of a low because obviously Henrik Larsson played his final game competitively in the Scottish Cup final against Dunfermline Athletic. It was a game that Paul Lamb and I actually discussed in our recent Match Worn Jersey podcast because he had the number 7 jersey from the Dunfermline Cup final 3-1. And it was one of the games that was just written in the stars. It was going to be a Henrik Larsson final when he just showed his class once again. He then got a testimonial.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Which was strange after 7 years, but I think that was obviously written into his last contract, Kevin, that he would get this match where obviously he would make a few quid before he left. But I think the tears after that game were genuine tears from Henrik Larsson. I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever about that. And I asked Paul the question. It's an interesting one because Larsson's obviously been named quite a few times as being a potential Celtic manager. And in actual fact, he was approached. It was when Ronnie Dyla got the job, wasn't it? He was approached as a manager and he didn't take it. I don't think he is a manager. I think looking at his appointments up to now, he's never shown anything to suggest that he would be a coach or a manager of any kind of distinction. However, he's one of the figures, one of the modern day icons that it would be good to have him at Celtic Park in some capacity, Kevin. And I don't mean jobs for the boys. I'm talking about the tradition that Celtic have of having ex-Celts as part of the boot room or part of the backroom team. Is Henrik Larsson worth having on the staff?
I listened to that podcast that you done with Paul Lamb, and one thing I would say, I actually do see that green top as silver. You says it was grey, but I see it as silver. And if folk are listening to this, haven't they listened to that podcast, you'll understand what I mean if you go and listen to it. Some players suit football clubs, and some players are only successful at certain football clubs, and that goes into their coaching and managing career. And it could be that Larsson would have been a success as a manager because he knew the environment and he knew the expectations when he came to Celtic, when coming back. And it could be him being a coach at Celtic as well would bring out the best in him because it would be a relaxed atmosphere for him. I mean, when you see Henrik Larsson won the Champions League for Barcelona. He got a League Winners' Medal for Man United as well. But if you ask anybody, Henrik Larsson, they see him in the hoops. They see him in green and white, and Celtic is his spiritual home. And of course, I would love to see him at Lennox Town helping. I imagine any young lad coming through having Henrik Larsson as their coach. Any striker having Henrik Larsson telling them, by the way, this is. And it could just be that he's not cut out for management, but it could be a good foil, it could be a good part of a backroom team. That could be his personality. He could have he's got the knowledge, he's got the experience, and he's got the talent. So it would be a miss of Celtic not to approach him. But then that's up to Neil. That's up to the backroom staff. It's up the that's up to the management team that are already there. I mean, I don't know if Damien Duff's going to leave.
I'm never sure about these dual jobs. You know, when you get an international job, Kevin, and you keep your club job. I don't personally, who am I to say? But I'm not sure about that. I think you've either got a job, a full-time job, or not. And you're either with Celtic or you're with the Republic of Ireland. I mean, I don't know how that could work successfully. And I don't know if it ever has. I'm pretty sure people are shouting at the podcast with loads of examples where it's actually worked perfectly well. But You know, I'm not saying get Duff out, bring in Larson, but it goes back to an argument that you and I raised, or a debate rather. We were trying to think of the last prolific Celtic striker. A couple of names have been thrown up on Twitter since we had that discussion, Kevin, and Sean Maloney's been mentioned. I never ever kind of thought Maloney was an out-and-out striker, but yeah, point taken, Maloney scored goals. You mentioned Forrest on the night, and of course Forrest has been prolific, but he's not a striker, is he? He's right side, what would you call him, a right winger, outside right, depending on your era. And, you know, maybe we do need somebody in there, someone who, for all intents and purposes, could well be a striker coach, you know. And I'm not saying get them to work with under-13s, but it's quite worrying that if the last homegrown striker that we've produced who has been prolific is Charlie Nicholas back in the early 80s, then that's a bit of a concern, I would have thought. You know, and if you produce your own goal-scoring striker, then you're going to save yourself tens of millions of pounds. We've had to spend, you know, £9 million on Edouard and many other millions on others who didn't score the goals. So I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just romanticism, Kevin. Maybe we're looking back on Larson, the player. But I just think someone who could be a role model for young players coming in, someone who knows the club. Obviously, there's a relationship already there with Neil Lennon. It doesn't look as though Henrik Larsson's going to move into the punditry as maybe John Hartson and Chris Sutton has. And I just think, as you say, it's a spiritual home for him. It would be a good move and it would be well received, wouldn't it? Maybe in the next few years we'll see him back.
It would be extremely well received, but I'm not for giving jobs to people who haven't got the ability to do it. If sometimes you see the nepotism in other walks of life, and sometimes you do see it in football as well. And for me,
are you thinking of Liam Brady with Mick Martin? Around about that time, every manager that came in had like three or four guys. You're like, who's that? Remember, Ashley Grimes, who's that, you know? And no, you're absolutely right. Every single person needs to fulfil a particular role. And, you know, again, we're going back to maybe looking at Neil Lennon having not assembled that team himself, you know, the backroom team, because of the circumstances of his appointment at that time. And when he did put together his own team, it was people like Mialbe, Alan Thompson, Gary Parker. So maybe Larson wouldn't be one of his boys anyway. But obviously, I don't think Thompson would be given a job again at Celtic Park, and because he, obviously the circumstances under which he left the first time round. But, and I don't think Mialbe would either, because he's elsewhere now. So you never know. You just never know. It would be good to see Larson back.
If Duff does leave, it would be interesting to see who is appointed and whether it is a Lennon man or another highly rated coach from somewhere else where Celtic are maybe trying to create a boot room. And are we going to see the day when, obviously, Neil's only a year and a bit into the job at this precise moment in time for the second time, but the shelf life for a Celtic manager is maybe 3 seasons. And will John Kennedy maybe get the nod after Lennon goes? Will John be a big enough personality? Because I think we discussed this when Brendan Rodgers left. If they rated John Kennedy highly enough, then he would have got the job. But I reckon he never got the job when Rodgers left because he wasn't a big enough personality, and they needed somebody with broad shoulders to take it on. So I don't know. Maybe Kennedy's just one of these guys that's going to be a number two. But it's an interesting point. And of course you would love to see Henrik Larsson back there. Of course you would love to see him celebrating on the touchline, being part of the backroom staff. But I would only take him back if the management team wanted him back and he could contribute to the ongoing success of Celtic Football Club.
We might look back on this podcast and say you heard it here first. So in 2004, I've already mentioned that John Squire released an album. Kevin, for anyone who's listened to A Celtic State of Mind, they'll realise before now that both yourself and I are Stone Roses fans. And in 2004, Ian Brown released his fourth solo record. It was a departure from Music of the Spheres. And there's actually a song on there called One Way Ticket to Paradise. So maybe it's written in the stars that Larson will come back. What did you think of Solarised?
I loved it as an album. I really did. For the opening track, alongside M13, I really liked. Obviously, you don't keep what you got with Noel Gallagher on it. And it was a good album. I went to see him on that tour, and I'm sure that was a tour he done with the Stone Roses tribute band, Made of Stone, as his backing band. And he'd done a few Roses numbers. It's a good album. Again, it's got all the Ian Brown sort of tropes as you would. It's political, bit of hip hop, a bit of stoned grooves. It's a decent album, it is.
Time Is My Everything, I thought, was a fantastic track as well, which came out as a single. And the other one, which is an album track, which you and I, again, we mention that quite a lot, Kevin, you know, tracks that never released are singles, and therefore they're often not heard, really, you know, on radio, etc. But Kiss Your Lips, No ID, which was a political song talking about, or it was a message around the ID cards that the government were trying to implement, or they're certain talk about that at that time. But it was, I thought also, the fact that Aziz Ibrahim was involved in the writing of some tracks again, which is always a welcome thing for me, because I think him and Ian Brown work well together. Not kind of heard from Aziz in relation to Ian Brown's kind of later stuff. But I think when they work together, they do have a really good songwriting partnership. So, other albums that were released in 2004, Kevin, fire away.
That year, I would have been listening to... I liked the U2 album that came out that year, How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. There was a couple of cracking singles off that, Vertigo, what a fantastic U2 song, and The City of Blinding Lights. That was a really decent album. Kasabian also released Kasabian that year, an album which we speak about the Primal Scream quite often. And Kasabian, that album by Kasabian, wouldn't have been possible without the Primal Scream doing Exterminator 4 years earlier, because that was the sort of techno, pop, punk crossover that Kasabian went on to sell to the masses. Another album, a Liverpool band, The Zootons, Who Killed The Zootons, that album kind of passed under the radar, but then got another lease of life when Amy Winehouse covered Valerie, which was on that album for them. What else?
Interestingly enough, two members of the Zootons had been in a band with Edgar Summertime Jones just before they left to become superstars with the Zootons, which is the story of Edgar's life, it would appear. But yeah, big fan of the Zootons album. Just going back to your U2 point there, Kevin, before you move on to your next section of music from that era. U2, first band ever seen, I think I've said that. First band ever seen live, 1993 at Celtic Park. But I'm just now thinking, I stopped listening to U2 after the Pop album, and I probably didn't buy How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. I don't think I've bought a U2 album since. So my interest in the band, you know, there was always U2 albums kicking around the house in the 1980s, you know, the Joshua Tree, Rattlin' Hum, that kind of thing. And I loved Actuin Baby, Zooropa, and certain elements of pop. But then after that, I've never really been into them after that, you know. So I probably got off the bus just at the right time.
I must admit my interest waned after this album, because I can't say that I've listened to any albums since. But the two albums that they released in the early noughties, All That You Can't Leave Behind and this one, How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, are probably two of my favourite U2 albums, to tell you the truth, eh? Up there with Acton Baby. Well, maybe not up there with Acton Baby, because Acton Baby is a career-defining record, for me anyway. But they were probably the last two U2 albums that I was interested in.
And Kasabian, I mean, I remember when Kasabian, you know, made their entrance, so all the music writers were making those references. They were talking about, oh, this should have been the album that the Stone Roses wrote after Fool's Gold and all this kind of stuff, and the Primal Scream references were there. I'm not sure Kasabian went down the road that I expected them to. I mean, I don't think they care what I think, but you know, no. It's again not a band that they could release a record this year and I probably wouldn't buy it now, you know. But I did like the first few albums.
I'm like yourself. I wouldn't say I'm a massive Kasabian fan now. Every so often a song from the first album comes on, like ID or Lost Souls Forever, and I've been to see them live a number of times and they always do a great show. But there's just something now that they just seem to be repeating the same formula. And it's the old, they're good at what they do, and I know that they're good at what they do, but I mentioned last week again, it's like a photocopy, what was it Richard Ashcroft says, a Xerox.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm probably are with Kasabian at this precise moment in time.
To be honest with you, Kasabian, right, there we go, Kasabian, they're better than Keane, and Keane released an album this year. They're better than the Ordinary Boys, you know, I'm not slagging them off to that degree, and I did, as I say, I did invest in them for a few albums. It's just that a band's longevity is something that's it's quite difficult for them to keep you interested over a period of, let's say, 7, 8, 9 albums, you know. But
is there a link here to a management, a manager's shelf life as well? Have bands got a shelf life of 3 albums then? That should really be it. See how managers say you can't last any longer than 3 seasons or the players stop listening to you. So do you think bands
it's a difficult one.
That,
eh? It's a whole question of relevance, and it all comes down to whether or not these days people will be prepared to buy tickets to watch you, because, and I've used this reference a few times, whereby in the past you would release a record and then tour the record, but now you announce a tour and then you release a record to promote the tour.
But then I'm thinking about that, and Kasabian are still releasing music, which is bypassing me. But bands like Suede, James, the stuff that they're doing now is just as good as the stuff that were doing in 2004. So I don't know, maybe Kasabian are a bit more relevant, and that gives them a bit more pressure, where bands like James and that, who are James, Suede, Ride, even Ride have released 2 fantastic albums since they've got back together. Maybe it's just the fact is they know that they're going to sell a set amount of records, a set amount of tickets. They know that they're not going to headline, transmit. So their creativity just, there's no pressure on them, and they just do what they want to do.
You know, Kasabian could never sell out a stadium. You know, they could never take that step to the Oasis level. And the Courteeners, a band that I have no interest in whatsoever, but they've done it. And various others, Jerry Cinnamon's done it. Kasabian couldn't do that off their own back, you know. So you've got bands that continually release records, like a couple you've mentioned, Suede, James, The Charlatans, and it hits a ceiling point where they're never going to then take it to the stadiums. They're never going to have a hit in the States, you know. So I think that it comes down to that, and then it's really just a question of whether the guys in or girls in the band want to continually tour, because that must be bloody a difficult thing. Talking to Kevin Miles just the other night, the actual, you know, going on a world tour sounds great, but the reality of it is maybe not so great. And it probably just comes down to whether or not they want to do that at a certain stage in their life. Some of the other albums that touched a chord with me during this particular year, Brian Wilson, Smile, The Go Team, Thunder, Lightning, Strike. Don't know if you're a big fan of The Go Team. I thought they were tremendous. Probably still are. Kings of Leon, Aha, Shake, Heartbreak. Are you a Kings of Leon fan, Kevin?
I stopped listening to them when they shaved off their beards.
I didn't know that you were into hipsters, Kevin. I never realised you were one of them, one of these hipsters. And you've already mentioned a few of the others. The Killers, Hot Fuss, Not Fussed, if you ask me about The Killers or anything they've ever done. Morrissey, You Are The Quarry. For a moment, forget about his politics. For a moment, we'll talk about his album regarding the songs on it, and we'll not forget his politics, but we certainly won't discuss them at the moment, because we don't agree with his politics, and he's completely ruined his reputation by voicing his right-wing views. But there's a song on that album, You Are The Quarry, called All The Lazy Dykes. Now, All The Lazy Dykes. Now, I know I'm struggling to get my fourth book out after 5 years, right? But I think that's a bit harsh, All The Lazy Dykes. Morrissey's album, You Are The Quarry, came out this year, as did Razorlight by Razorlight. Now, Razorlight's career fell off the edge of a cliff, didn't it?
I know. That was one of the bands who flirted with stadium stardom as well. Then the press decided they didn't like the front man. What was the front man's name? Johnny Burrell. That was the front man's name, eh?
It was. His name is probably Johnny Borrell, but we just call him Johnny Burrell.
That's the Scottishness in us, eh? Just add an extra syllable. I can't. You just mentioned the name Razorlight, and that horrible song America's just gone through my head now.
But sorry.
That Morrissey album, Irish Blood, English Heart's a good song. I must admit that's a really, really good song. And First of the Gang to Die, that's a fantastic.
Superb.
That's a fantastic wee tune. So
brilliant track.
Definitely is, eh? So, it's just a shame. We're in a strange quandary now with Morrissey, eh? We're in a quandary where we didn't like you, but you have actually made some good music, actually, to tell you.
Listen,
so
Morrissey Smiths are Paolo Di Canio's gold boots. right? The pair of them can be put in a box and removed out the road entirely when it comes to politics, but we can't airbrush them out of history. The influence of the Smiths, the influence of some of the Morrissey solo material, Kevin, is such that you can't airbrush them because they have either developed right-wing views politically, or they've always had them but just never voiced them until a certain stage of their lives. So we certainly can't champion them, and I would never champion Morrissey or Di Canio in relation to their political views. But you've got to admit, All the Lazy Dykes was a good track, and so was First of the Gang to Die. So, yeah, that was a good album. That was an excellent solo album. Couple I'd throw in and ask you about the Libertines. Now, I just hate that grotty, smacked-up band vibe of the Libertines, and in particular Pete, or Peter, whatever he wants to be known as now, Docherty, you know, this guy who sells himself as this kind of urban poet, you know, this classical guy that can't wash his fingernails. I just don't buy that. I really just don't buy it. The music's not good enough to pull that off, unfortunately. What's your thoughts on the Libertines?
The Libertines were probably the first band after Oasis who sort of grabbed a scene, who sort of appeared from nowhere. And obviously they were in this sort of London scene, and they were hanging about with journalists. And I'm a bit like you. I used to watch a lot of MTV too around about this time, and the video for Don't Look Back Into the Sun, when it was the Queen's birthday or something like that, and they're jumping about with Chelsea pensioner uniforms on and that, and it's a catchy wee song, and that was about it. But I think Pete Docherty released something that year with the Wolfman called Four Lovers.
Yeah,
I thought that was a fantastic song. I really did.
That was a good wee ditty.
I thought that was a fantastic song. But I'm a bit like you. It's a posh boy going off the rails, eh? And it's that sort of heroin chic where making the no getting washed for a week's a statement. It's a fashion statement rather than a necessity, eh? And this sort of waif and stray waster persona. Me and you have done jobs.
It's contrived. The problem is it's contrived.
Me and you have worked with guys and seen guys, and you see them all in any village in Stirling and Fife, especially now standing outside the chemist waiting to go in for their methadone shots, and they're not living the Pete Docherty lifestyle. It just doesn't sit right with me whatsoever. And as you say, the music probably wasn't strong enough to carry it off either, even though I did like that Four Lovers songs. And it is contrived. You're right, what you're saying there, it is contrived.
Totally contrived. But there was one wee story that I did enjoy, and it's definitely made up. But Pete Docherty says that he wrote Dreaming of You and he sold it to the Coral and a Camden Boozer for 50 quid. So it was quite a good purchase for the Coral, I would suggest, because they've done it pretty well. And the other band, again, are the Celtic fans? Who knows? Somebody out there will know. Franz Ferdinand.
Never got into Franz Ferdinand.
Why? Because of the kind of art school thing, kind of like too cool for school?
Maybe that's got something to do with it. I just maybe found them that... No, that I've got nothing against artists or anything like that. There's a bit...
Would you look upon them more favourably if they were called Les Ferdinand?
Because Anton in actual Ferdinand. Fact... if they were called
here's
Anton
your
Ferdinand...
Here's your QPR reference right here. Pete Docherty, or Doherty, used to write for a QPR fanzine. So there's all this different thing. And Morrissey's a QPR fan as well. And Morrissey's cousins with Robbie Keane.
Is he?
Morrissey is Robbie Keane's first cousin, you know? So there's all this linkage. It doesn't mean to say we need to like them. To be honest with you, I was into the first album. I thought Franz Ferdinand's first album was very good. And I thought after that, couldn't tell you anything they've done, but I enjoyed the first album.
I'm going to say about Franz Ferdinand that it just sort of came to me. I thought their art schoolness was too obvious.
Again, was it contrived?
Maybe I believed it was contrived.
They just maybe were too smart for their own good.
Every band has got their influences. Now, Franz Ferdinand, I've got the Talking Heads influence, they've got the art school influence, and the guitarist was doing the guy for Dr. Feelgood.
Wilco.
Wilco Johnson. And the guitarist style was Wilco Johnson. I think I just maybe found him a bit too obvious. Maybe. at the time. But see, if they're Celtic fans, I absolutely love them.
Aye, because they might be on this podcast, so you better watch.
Absolutely love them. I'll revisit them, and I'm sure I'll love everything they've ever done if they are Celtic fans.
And you love art school stuff as well, don't you, mate? So there we go.
I've got nothing against art school folk before I get folk sending me messages. I just found it a bit obvious.
A lot of these bands have stated that they only went to art school to join a band. You know, I think Blur, I think The Clash. Didn't The Clash go to art school?
Aye, I've got nothing against art school. Nothing against it whatsoever.
Well, it comes across as you do, Kevin. Aye, so there you go. Franz Ferdinand, a wee bit too obvious for you, but I thought it was a good album. I might just go back and listen to it. I quite liked their videos as well. Their videos were quite well put together, the animation in the videos. And if you've got a Talking Heads influence, you're doing okay as well, because Talking Heads were just mind-blowing. Brilliant. They were before their time.
Definitely. There was another album released this year, Interpol Antics. And I remember at the time when Interpol were on the front cover of the NME and stuff like that being spoke about in the NME, I just thought they sound a bit like Joy Division. I love that album now. But at the time, I thought they were just too obvious with the Joy Division influence. But I've went back and I do love that Interpol album now.
A big part of the Scream of Celica experience for me, Kevin, is obviously you do some research before each show, but at the same time, you go away having discussed a lot of the other bands and music that either passed you by or you've kind of lost interest and you go back. We put an article up on the site this week to announce that Badly Drawn Boy's releasing his 9th album, and then you furiously go back and think, well, I haven't heard the last 5, so, you know, there must be something in one of the albums that would stand out. So these things are interesting. Franz Ferdinand, I've no idea how many albums they've released, but I thought their debut album was all right, and Interpol as well. Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's another band that's appeared in the live section of the Axom.net website. Kevin, it's been an absolute pleasure once again. We started off with The Streets. We spoke about Morrissey. We spoke about Paolo Di Canio's Gold Boots and Alex Kapranos. Is he a Celtic fan or not? If he is, we might try and get him on a future episode of A Celtic State of Mind. Kevin, thanks again, and I'll speak to you next week.
Thanks very much, Paul. Cheers.
Network. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.